Well, as at the end of our last class, we were talking about the McNaughton defense and about the issue of mens rea, as the state of mind that a person has when you know, they engage in some kind of criminal act. And earlier, you know, I had mentioned to you, in some states people are found not guilty by reason of insanity. In other states, people are found guilty but mentally ill. Now, the most famous case, you know, in the last decade or so, was the case of John Hinckley. If you remember, you know, John Hinckley was the person who attempted to assassinate Ronald Reagan when Ronald Reagan was president. And he did not hit President Reagan, but he did seriously injure President Reagan's secretary, James Brady. And so Mr. Hinckley was then brought to trial, and he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. Now, this really incensed people. And, you know, and it was a very sad kind of comment, because, you know, people felt, if you attempt to murder the president, remember, the president didn't get hit. It was his press secretary who suffered this terrible wound. But if you attempt to assassinate the president, you know, you should not get away with it, because you were delusional. And that has, you know, led, I think, in some cases, for states to consider this other, you know, way of looking at things, that is guilty but mentally ill. Now what's happened, of course, and by the way, when the public outcry came about this, it was really due to a lot of misinformation about how many people were allegedly avoiding crimes because they were being found to be mentally ill. Actually, the research that's been done on this shows that the insanity plea occurs in only about 1 out of every 200 criminal cases. That is, it occurs in about 1 out of every 200. It's successful in about 2 in 1,000. So it's not like the judges are just turning all kinds of people out, and defense lawyers are doing this really, you know, good job of, you know, claiming people are mentally ill when they're not. Actually, it's a very rare finding that someone was mentally ill when they committed a crime, and that's upheld. It's also important, you know, that we at least note that psychologists and psychiatrists do serve as expert witnesses. But they no longer do it, as I mentioned, to determine that somebody actually was in a certain psychological state at the time the crime occurred. But there is a way around that, as I described to you. But the important thing is that once the experts testify, instead of the experts coming to a conclusion and saying, this person was psychotic, was deranged in some way, was psychologically unable to understand what he or she was doing at the time the crime occurred, that judgment is now left to the jury, or to the judge, or to both. So the expert is only able to kind of describe all the circumstances and all the things that they know about the person who is being tried. But you cannot make the statement that the person was or was not sane at that time. You just give all the evidence that might lead one to draw that conclusion. But the jury has to draw that conclusion. And that's really a different. Now, I mentioned earlier, so I'm not going to go into it again, but you know, the idea of predicting is something that has to be very carefully looked at. We still are not good predictors. That is, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, family therapists, psychiatric nurses, et cetera, all these people who do mental health work. And if you remember, I told you about the case of Tatiana Tarasoff, where, you know, action was actually brought against a psychologist and a clinic because they didn't inform somebody that they might be harmed by a person. But the you know, the reality is, when somebody says to you they are going to harm someone else, the distinction between whether that event is going to take place or whether that event is not going to take place is a very, very difficult to determine. Okay, and you remember, and we did discuss how that goes. Now, what I want to move on to actually are the tort cases, because psychologists are actually asked to testify about behavior in a wide range of cases that are called tort cases. These kinds of issues, they could involve slander, libel, medical malpractice, the manufacture of defective products that result in injury, intentional neglect or negligent behavior that produce harm to other people. All of these are tort cases that psychologists often are asked to participate in as expert witnesses. And often they're asked to testify whether there actually is any psychological research that might inform the court about the topic that's being looked at. And very complex cases can result from tort activities. For example, you know, airlines have worried for a long time about whether or not you should let people fly a plane after they turn 60. Kind of an arbitrary, you know, age, but when you think about it, the risk is so high that you do not want to have a pilot who is flying, you know, a 747 who might have lost some of his or her cognitive ability. Now, of course, the pilots took the position, which I think they should have taken, is that it's totally arbitrary to decide that at age 60, somebody can no longer fly a plane when the person might be very competent till they're 70 or later. So they did a lot of studies to determine, is there cognitive loss in pilots? Because this was entered into evidence in these cases. And actually, you know, there wasn't sufficient evidence to say that somebody who turned 60 really can't, shouldn't be allowed to continue to fly planes. What they compromised on, the last time I looked, was that I think after you become 60, you get examined every year. That is, you undergo a psychological or a neuropsychological evaluation so that it can be determined if you are beginning to lose some of the cognitive abilities that are necessary to fly a plane. But you can't just arbitrarily take an age and say this has happened to someone. And so, you know, many pilots continue to function very well. And of course, you know, the other side of that coin is if someone is still very sharp, you really don't want to lose the experience of somebody who is 60 years old, very competent pilot, and actually you'd prefer to have that person flying your plane. But it's but those kinds of cases, often when they're dealt with in court, actually the judge does permit a lot of social science data to be entered, and then the jury gets to hear, you know, whether or not from the perspective of science, of psychology in this case, what is being proposed actually is fair, or whether this is not a good idea. Now then, you know, psychologists are also very active in workers' compensation cases. Now, the workers' compensation law, which exists in all states and it also exists in the federal government, says that if you are injured on the job, you have certain rights. And injured on the job has broad you know, definition. It can actually be something physically that occurred on the job. It can be something psychological that occurred on the job. And if either of these conditions occur, and you can show that you are now either physically injured, you know, you were asked to lift things that are too heavy, or you weren't given the proper equipment to do it, et cetera, and now you have chronic back pain, or if you were harassed on the job, and the harassment has led to problems at home, inability to be responsive to the children, inability to do your job well, I mean, all kinds of issues that come up under this, but you can sue for damages. And then psychologists and other professionals become the witnesses that try to determine, is the case that you're bringing really one where there's evidence? Now, as you might guess, the dilemma is trying to determine how the person functioned before some event occurred. So let's say, you know, if you have a case where, let's say, someone has really been harassed, and this individual has experienced a great deal of anxiety, and they're not functioning well now. You know, the question becomes, number one, how well were they functioning before this harassment occurred? So you're trying to get, you know, kind of a baseline to start from. Then, you know, you have to be able to look at people, you know, similarly situated, and how might they have gone over time? That is, if you're often, you know, they have a test that they've given people in a lot of these jobs, so they kind of know how bright they are. They kind of know what the usual path would be. And if they had a couple of promotions, so they were on a certain path, and now because of the trauma of what has happened, they can no longer function, you're trying to measure, if that hadn't happened, then what other steps might they have taken on the job, and what kind of raises would they have gotten, and how much money would they eventually have made? Because that's going to have a lot to do with how much money they're going to get as a result of this case they're bringing. And now, sometimes it's about, say, something like harassment there, but other things happen on the job. There have been situations like, for instance, people working in a company, and somebody comes in and shoots people. There was a famous one of a toy company in Chicago where a person came in with a gun and just started shooting randomly and killed several people. But the people who survived, you know, some of them were really traumatized. And some felt they couldn't work there anymore. They couldn't come back to that setting. Other people just were traumatized for a period of time. It wasn't clear how long it would take them to get over this. But if the company is found to be responsible for not having provided the security they should have, then they become responsible for giving these people a certain amount of money for the kind of pain and suffering that they went through as a result of this. Now, people can also bring cases in workers' compensation for the cost of treatment that they receive for their injuries, and part of that can be psychotherapy. You know, somebody who witnessed a terrible event, like a shooting, and, you know, is just not able to get past it, so they go into therapy for a long time, they can seek to have all of that therapy paid for by the company or by the federal government. And now, it's interesting, you know, companies, of course, are somewhat resistant to paying this. Some companies are, because it's kind of an unknown cost sometimes. Once a person is in therapy, they may be in therapy for a long time because there may be some very complicated problems that are being dealt with, which may or may not have had anything to do with the trauma. The trauma may simply have brought out those problems. What I have found with the federal government is the federal government is certainly very willing to pay for trauma that has occurred with people who do things for the government that the public might not like to, might not like. That is, the government, in cases of people I've seen, has paid for treatment readily because they don't want the person to go to court. And their fear is, first of all, they recognize the person will probably win. But that's not the big issue. The big issue is there are things that people do in government work that the government would never want known. And while that statement can sound paranoid, it's not paranoid. It's very real. And so they pay for treatment. Probably there are some companies who do the same. But workers often, you know, are underpaid for the trauma they have. And so they have to go to court. And it's a difficult assessment trying to work out just what would have happened in this person's life. And of course, you can always challenge people like psychologists and psychiatrists and social workers, et cetera, on the grounds that, you know, we don't predict stuff very well. So how can we predict this person would have got six raises? And that's where research comes in, because what you try to do is you try to take the average person and you try to show what would have been the growth the likely, you know, growth of this person had they been able to function the way they were before the trauma. And so you seek to get them those benefits. Of course, if the person were much above average and might have gone on to do a lot more, it's a much more difficult case to argue. People can also, if they were traumatized and they just stopped working, they couldn't work. I mean, they felt like they couldn't go back to the scene of where there was a shooting, or they can't go back to work because the harassment has been so terrible. People can sue for lost wages. And again, you're going to be examining to see, you know, whether or not a case can be made psychologically that this person really did lose wages because of some kind of life experience. The same is true in the next category, which is the loss of future earnings. These are very difficult, you know, to predict, but there's enough research that does help you to do this and to really take a scientific position on what might have happened in someone's life if they were not injured. Now then we get to civil competencies. And there are a lot of examples here we can use. Is a person capable of managing personal financial affairs? Many, many cases about this. People get older, especially, and people begin to worry that dad or granddad really isn't capable of managing, you know, his money. And you get, you know, some very different kind of cases. I mean, first of all, it may be that good old granddad has really got a lot of money. And people may become worried that, you know, granddad's going to make a bad investment. They don't want him controlling all of this wealth. So they seek to have him declared not competent so that some other member of the family can protect the wealth. And courts, you know, try to be very careful about allowing that to take place. But if you examine someone, you can determine whether or not there's been significant cognitive loss and somebody really can't think clearly anymore. And in many, many of these cases, the psychologist finds the person is fine, that the family is worried, but they don't have the evidence to be able to say this person should lose you know, the right to take care of their money. The other you know, level is where the family is poor, and granddad or dad you know, actually has a minimal kind of income, but their family is worried that this person is not taking good care of that money, and the rest of the family doesn't have much money to help if he loses all the money. So often they want to take over that money as a way to ensure that, you know, dad will be taken care of, and dad doesn't want to do that. And when, you know, these things happen, sometimes these are done very lovingly and very caringly, but at the end of life, if you're still, you know, in the end stages of life, if you're still cognitively alive, you may not want to give up, you know, being able to make decisions about your money. Now then, there's the issue of, can a person make decisions about accepting or refusing medical or psychiatric treatment? You know, big, big issue today. And it used to be you could simply refuse psychiatric treatment. Now the courts have been more open. Not only have the courts, you know, that is, if you didn't take the treatment, you had to be bizarre enough that you could be committed. And if you noticed, I've been telling you how the commitment laws have got tougher and tougher, so it's not easy to commit somebody to a hospital if they don't want to be committed. But on the other side of the law, the courts have ruled that you can force a person, in some cases, to take medication if there's kind of overwhelming evidence that the person can't make a rational decision. And if they took the medication, they actually would be able to make rational decisions. And so, you know, and the testimony, of course, has to be that there's sufficient evidence that this particular medication given to someone with this particular diagnosis will be effective in a certain period of time. And the courts usually limit, you know, the amount of time that you can force someone to take medication. And in many cases, they don't even will not rule that you can force it. The same is medical treatment. And here, as you know, you have very complex problems that go far beyond psychology, because you get people who, for instance, will not allow their child to be treated for religious reasons. But, you know, physicians know that if this child is given this treatment, the child will be healthy. And if the child is not given this treatment, the child will die. You know, it may be a blood transfusion, or it may be a surgery that physicians do well. And the courts, you know, really struggle with this all the time. Now, in some cases, the issue has been brought that the parents are not doing this for religious reasons. They're doing this because they're psychotic. And religion has simply become incorporated into a very bizarre psychosis. Now, if you could demonstrate that, and if you can come in and show that actually the person's objection is not based on their religious beliefs, very hard thing to do, by the way, but if you can do that, then the judge might be freed up to say the child can be treated. Very, very difficult cases. Also, this you know, comes into things like what you would want done if you weren't competent to make a decision. Let me ask you, now, you're young. How many of you have a living will? Anybody here have a living will? So look at the age group here. See, I have a living will. For you, you haven't thought about it. Not surprising. When I was your age, I didn't think about it either. In fact, even as I got older, and my wife pointed out to me, my wife being a lawyer, points out to me, we should have living wills. I remember she drew one up exactly the way I wanted mine, and I still let it sit around for a few months before I signed it, because they really didn't want to deal with the issue that I could ever be in that state. But what living wills do is they allow medical people, let's say you had a terrible accident, and you're not going to recover. But they could keep you alive. You know, I mean, they can keep you on machines, and they can keep you alive for a long time. But in your living will say you don't want those kinds of actions taken. So that if you're ever in a vegetative state, for example, and there's no hope that you're going to recover, it's really okay to allow you to die. Depending on the state you're in, if you have a living will, almost every state will honor that. But if you don't have a living will and you're injured in some states, then their caution is they will keep you alive, even though it may be a great hardship to your family, who realize you'll never really be with them again. That is, you may never wake up, or if you do wake up, your EEG is flat, so you're never going to have any kind of cognitive function. And so the idea of making a living will is very important. And of course, it can happen at any age, but the older you get, the more likely it is that you will need a living will, or you should consider one. Psychologists then have testified about whether or not someone was competent at the time they made a living will to be able to make that judgment that this is what they really would want to have happen if such a trauma occurred in their life. So families have challenged living wills in the past, saying he or she who signed it didn't know what they were doing at that time. And then you have to try to go back and gather evidence as to, is it plausible that when this person did sign a living will, they actually didn't know what they were doing? Again, very, very hard to build this case. Also, can an individual execute a will that directs how property should be distributed to heirs and other beneficiaries? Of course, this comes after someone dies. Person dies, hadn't told the family about his or her will. Now the family finds out good old mom or dad is giving a lot of the money to the grandkids, or maybe worse, they're giving a lot of money to charity. We, the kids, aren't getting it. So we bring a case saying, you know, good old mom didn't know what she was doing. When mom made this will, she was loony. This would never have been her true intention. because Mom loved me, and she would surely have wanted me to inherit some of this money, maybe all of this money. And so the argument then becomes, was Mom competent to make this will at the time? Now, of course, you almost always have an attorney who, you know, was there, and an attorney who can testify that was his belief that this woman did know what she was doing. The problem, of course, is that attorneys are not experts in making those kinds of judgments. So then they begin looking for neurologists, psychologists, neuropsychologists especially, you know, people who might give expert testimony as to whether this person at that particular time could make such a judgment. Now, as you can imagine, you know, you get very, very difficult decisions here. And of course, when you make a decision in one direction, you also find experts who are going to make it in another direction. Now, probably the most touching cases that have come up are the right to die cases. And these are often, you know, referred to, I mean, as physician-assisted suicide. Physician-assisted death, you know, is probably a better, you know, description. But the reality is it is suicide in the sense the person is going to take their life. Now, the only state that actually has a law that physician-assisted suicide is okay is Oregon. And in Oregon's law, they actually require that a psychologist examine the person so that it is clear this person is not making this decision simply because they're depressed. That is, when people are depressed at any age, people often think that death is the solution. And so depressed people become suicidal. So Oregon decided, even if the person is quite old, and even if they're physically quite ill, there's still the real possibility, and this certainly is accurate, that the person may be depressed. And if they weren't so depressed, they would not choose to end their life right now. Even though they have an incurable illness, even though perhaps they experience a considerable amount of pain. So the judgment has to be, this person is not significantly depressed. This person knows what he or she is doing. And they feel it's time to end life because life is near the end anyway. That is, they have a terminal illness. They are going to die very soon. But perhaps there's a lot of pain associated with them staying alive. They may have become incontinent. They may have lost, you know, a lot of their functions. And so the person makes a rational decision to die. Now, all of us may be too strong, but most of us certainly have a lot of difficulty with this. You know, have a lot of difficulty with a loved one who wants to die now, even though they're quite old and enfeebled, and we can see their suffering. And, you know, and after they die, you know, we often say that was merciful. You know, the person died and, you know, we didn't want to see them suffer. But when they're alive, to make the decision that it's really okay to, you know, stop giving them the IVs and the things that sustain their life, that's very hard to do. And so now we have people who realize that the family can't decide that, so they want to decide it. So Oregon has become the first state who has said, this really is okay. Now, as you know, like in Michigan, where we have the, you know, many of the famous physician-assisted suicides, the physician who was involved in that's in jail, in prison. And because they've aggressively gone after him for murder, even though in all of the cases, you know, the people have been examined and the people, and they have them on videotape saying, I really do want to end my life. But the courts have said, you know, it doesn't matter if you want to end your life. In our state, you can't do that. So if you do that, the person who helps you is going to go to jail. Now also, there is the issue of psychological autopsies. And here is where psychologists are asked to render an opinion about somebody after they have died. Now you might wonder, why would anybody want to do a psychological autopsy? I mean, it's one thing, a lot of reasons you can think of for doing physical autopsies, because it may be, first of all, you want to determine what were the physical causes of death, and you may discover certain illnesses that this person may have had that were unknown, and that may be relevant to living family members. So there may be all kinds of reasons why you would do a physical autopsy, but why do you do a psychological autopsy? Well, the cases that are often, these cases are often raised because a family is claiming that a business contributed to a suicidal or accidental death of a person. So they're saying, you know, this person died in an accident at work, but it was because of the circumstances at work that this person actually did something or didn't do something that led to their death. Also, families may be concerned whether a person had the capacity to execute or modify a will, as I've said when we talked about wills. You know, sometimes a family doesn't want the person to be able to make a will right now because they're worried. But after the person dies, they also come, as I'd said earlier, and raise the issue, was the person really competent to do that? And then there's been a new one that's come up more recently, and that is whether a person wanted to die and they arranged the circumstances whereby they would be killed. And, you know, this is most often you know, referred to as like suicide by police. It's a tricky issue, but we now know it's a real phenomenon. That is, somebody who's terribly depressed perhaps commits a very minor crime. You know, they're robbing a store of a few things, but and they do it in such a bungling way that the police are called. And the police come and the person, you know, runs out and the person is holding a gun, perhaps. And the police tell the person to throw the gun down, and the person doesn't do it, and the person stands there with the gun, which, by the way, may have no bullets in it. In fact, that's been one of the reasons why we've been able to pursue some of this. And the person holds a gun out like this, so the police shoot the person, and the person dies. Well, when people have gone back and began to examine what was going on with this person? I mean, the person put the police in this incredibly impossible situation. The police felt they had to shoot because this person was going to shoot. They killed the person, and they find out the person robbed the store of $2. The person had a gun with no bullets. So, and he's dead. And we have found that in any number of cases, the person has been acutely depressed prior to this episode. Person has, and often there's a series of things. This person has minimal resources. Person has lost his job, has no prospect of employment in the future, has no money, has told friends, you know, I really would like to die. And friends have been worried about the person, that the person might end his life. The person may have, with the little money they have, acquired an insurance policy, a life insurance policy recently, which they're leaving to someone that they care about. So they can't commit suicide, because if they commit suicide, the policy won't be any good. So they manage to get themselves killed. And so in a psychological autopsy, you know, you begin to examine all these variables to determine, was this someone who really was motivated to be killed? And it's very important, because if you really come to that conclusion, you also are saving often grieving police officers who killed someone. And to be a police officer who actually shot somebody for a minor robbery in which the person had an unloaded gun, that's really not something you want to have. And of course, if you're a white police officer and you happen to have shot a minority victim, often, there's a lot of rage that this is typical of the police. They kill people without cause, when in reality, the policeman in this particular case probably had no choice. But a lot of complications come, and so the autopsy helps to demonstrate the police officer really needed to do what he did. The victim really wanted and set up the circumstances for this event to occur, and that the victim had reasons for doing it. Now also, there's the issue of family court, where psychologists are very much in evidence. And you know, now that you have high divorce rates, you've got blended families, you've got single parents, the field of establishing child custody or determining parental rights and parental and whether you know parents are fit to have the custody of the child become very complex issues. And often these things are argued greatly. Now, as I was mentioning before in terms of the insanity defense, where the insanity defense depends on what state you're in, so do child custody laws depend on what state you're in. So you always have to know what the local norms are, because each state determines its own criteria for child custody. Now, what you can say in general, which is unfortunate, is that biological parents have a very strong legal advantage over any other claimant. And you know, this in itself, you know, is one of those things where you see how the law doesn't accept psychological knowledge perhaps the way they should. You get people making a claim as a biological parent after the child is 12 or 13 years old. The child didn't even know this person was a parent. You even get some extreme cases where somebody didn't know, and it would be the man, the father didn't even know he was the father of this child. He finds out when the child's 12 that actually he was the father of this child. Now he wants custody of the child. Meanwhile, the child has been raised by foster parents whom the child has always seen as his or her parents, and they love their parents, and the parents are very good. And all of a sudden, somebody lays claim on the basis that they're the biological parent. The law actually has had real difficulty with this. That is, the law has actually given custody over to a biological parent when the child actually has always believed these other two people were his or her parents, and the child was happy, and the child was growing up. And with the idea that biology is more important than psychology, when of course, you know, we would argue just the opposite is the case, that biology in this case is not important at all. Psychology is terribly important. That is, whoever raised the child is the child's parents. In some states, the law is whoever created the child, even if they did nothing for the child for many years, are still have first right of parenthood. So that gets argued. Now, also every state takes a very strong stand on child abuse. But the practice of varies from state to state in terms of what actually has to happen for a court to determine that a parent is unfit. And physical abuse, rather than psychological abuse, is much easier to determine. And it receives a lot more attention from the courts. So, you know, if you can show a child is being physically abused, you know, a physician come in and say, you know, this kid could only have this leg problem because the kid was hit, or the kid was neglected, or things like that. Those kinds of things are more powerful in court than saying, you know, this child is not nurtured. This child is constantly being abused verbally by both parents. The child is terribly depressed because of the environment in the home. The child actually is quite bright, but at school the child's dysfunctional. Even when you bring all those kinds of things, often it's very difficult for the courts to take the child from the parents if you're just trying to show psychological abuse. So you have to do a very thorough job. That is, you really have to be able to demonstrate that this child, let's say, really is quite bright, that you just have to look at the level of performance at school, and you have to be able to show that the level of performance at school is not simply because the child is lazy, and often you have to have interviewed teachers who will tell you that, you know, I've observed this child in my class and the kid is terribly unhappy, the child is frightened a lot, child keeps to herself, the child won't play in games because he's afraid that something terrible will happen, or he's so malnourished that he doesn't have the energy to do it, et cetera, et cetera. But more and more, we recognize that if you leave the child in that environment, very bad things are likely to happen. The courts, on the other hand, are really catching up with this, and they haven't caught up. The one thing you can say is, again, like in mental health courts and in child custody courts, often the judges are very good. Often the judges, really know a lot about children, and they've really taken a look at developmental theories, and they can make some very good observations. Now, psychologists tend to be, more active, actually, when the issue is custody and there's a divorce occurring. And most states actually would prefer that that there be joint custody. And psychologically speaking, of course, that's, you would hope that that would be the case. But often there are issues where joint custody is not a good idea, that one parent is almost sure to be neglectful, the other parent really needs the freedom to make decisions about the child, and you have to come in and explain, very clearly why it is that one parent should not have the same involvement with the child as the other. Now, your book notes that, these evaluations are not things you do easily. I mean, they may take, 30 hours. So, somebody may be paying $5,000 or $6,000, to have such an evaluation. Because not only would you test the child, perhaps, to see the child's abilities, but also you might want to observe the child in the home, and you might want to observe the child in school, and you might want to interview the parents, and you would want to interview teachers. And so you can have a lot of variables operating, and it just takes a long time to make a really good assessment of what is in the best interest of this child when there's a custody battle. And now the courts have improved, I think, significantly in that as the child gets older, many judges are more interested in listening to the child and seeing who the child wants to be with. So if your report supports what the child is actually saying he or she wants, that can be tremendously helpful in determining and helping the judge to determine who is going to get custody. As our society, matures and as it grows, of course, we get new issues. And so courts are struggling now with things like, supposing you have a divorce. The reason for the divorce is that one parent has decided that he or she is gay. And in fact, they're already involved with another gay person. And so the one parent is contesting that this person shouldn't have any rights to custody, or they at least should have major custody of the child, and the gay parent should not. Well, it may be that the gay parent is far better prepared and far more motivated to take care of the child than is the heterosexual parent. And the courts really are listening to these cases now. I mean, in fact, courts are beginning to realize the important thing for a child is to have loving parents or a loving parent. And of course, as this has gone on now, the courts have been allowing in many states gay couples to adopt children. And the research, has showed so far that this is actually a very good thing. I mean, a child who is being raised by two loving parents does very well. The sexual orientation of the parent seems to have no effect on the sexual orientation of the child. And gay parents, are not eager that their children be gay. They want their children to be happy. If their children turn out to be gay, they turn out to be gay. If their children turn out to be heterosexual, which, by the way, is what most commonly happens, that's fine. Those have been, real advances, but when that's the issue. There's still enough prejudice in our culture. There's still enough worry on the part of judges that they want, expert opinion that this child will be safe in that relationship and that it really is in the child's best interest that they go with that parent. Now, there's a case of psychologists being expert witnesses. And I've mentioned that phenomenon several times. The truth is, psychologists have not distinguished themselves as being expert witnesses, nor, to be honest with you, has any other discipline. And it's not uncommon in today's courts, especially if the parties who are arguing with each other are quite wealthy, that you got three psychologists testifying on one side and you've got three psychologists testifying on the other side. And it tells you how unfortunate it is that we don't have the kind of information available where you can really take a well-informed stand in a lot of issues. And really, you know, the science would argue that one way of doing it is certainly superior to another. Now, there are cases where you do get experts on both sides. And on one side, the experts are very legitimate scientists who are really using scientific evidence and clinical evidence to say, this is what should happen in this particular case. And you've got people on the other side who simply are kind of hired guns. That is, they make a lot of money being expert witnesses, and they manage to find some data to support an opinion. But one really has to question, you know, whether or not their testimony is really scientifically valid. Now, that's when psychologists who are on one side can be very helpful if they can show their side that scientifically what the position they're taking is really well supported. And the other side, if you examine the data they're using, these are very poor data. And this is not reliable, and people should not pay attention to it. You also get into very complicated cases as an expert witness. And while I'm saying I don't think psychology has done a good job, I myself have been an expert witness a number of times. And you find strange things. One time I was an expert witness on a case in which the City of Los Angeles Mental Health Association was suing the California Department of Mental Health because they felt the California Department of Mental Health was spending too much money on inpatient care. And in this particular case, California was spending about 90% of the mental health dollar on inpatient care, whereas the vast majority of people who needed help were outpatients. So they wanted to change the budget. They couldn't get them to change the budget. And I was testifying because I had run a program, an alternative to hospitalization program. And so they brought in a couple of us from around the country who had run alternatives to show that you could spend the money more wisely by having alternative programs rather than having programs that where you put people in a hospital because they're always the most expensive. Well, anyway, when I got there, I found that the person testifying before me, who was testifying for the plaintiff, was the director of the State Department of Mental Health, and he was the defendant. So the defendant testified as an expert witness for the plaintiff. You don't find this very often, but he wanted to lose. He felt that the State Department of Mental Health was spending too much money, but it couldn't get the governor and the state legislature to change the way in which the budget was assigned. And so here you have all these people testifying, and you have to go to court. And of course, the judge hearing this trial, you know, was a very sharp guy. And he realized that there had to be a trial, and he realized that there had to be a finding that the state government was acting irrationally and actually bringing harm. I mean, the key issue in this is that harm was being brought because the people who could have been helped if there was more outpatient money weren't getting helped because the money wasn't being put there. But you get cases like that. Now, you also get frivolous ones. I remember I used to be a consultant to the Illinois Attorney Disciplinary Commission. And so they often heard cases about lawyers who were being disbarred. I remember one case where I was, you know, in the trial, the judge says, or the attorney, I should say, for the plaintiff in this case, wants his license back. Now, what he had done is he had defrauded a client. He had taken money that the client put up for his defense and he had taken it and gambled it away, and he had been so dysfunctional, this lawyer had been so dysfunctional, that he didn't defend the person properly, and so the person sued him for lack of defense and for spending this money he shouldn't have spent that had been put in escrow. And the disciplinary commission found that the lawyer had acted unethically. Well, now his defense was that he was alcoholic and that he really didn't know what he was doing. And so, since he's not alcoholic anymore, he really should be reinstated to the bar. And so when I examined him, one of the things that I learned was that prior to the act of actually spending this money that was in escrow, this man had not had a drink in 4 years. So taking the position that his alcoholism actually was the significant influence on why he spent this money was a bizarre, you know, position to take. And so the outcome was that they did not give him his license back. Now, what you can see is there's, and I've just given you a smattering of what actually goes on in forensic psychology. I mean, there's really a huge number of things to do. It's a very fascinating field. I mean, I've always found when you're in that, it's very challenging, and of course, it's very adversarial. I mean, normally, when you're saying something, people on the other side are saying something else. So you don't want to do this unless you, first of all, you ethically feel what you're doing is right, and scientifically, you feel there's real evidence to support whatever it is you're going to say. Well, let me say I have very much enjoyed having the opportunity to work with you. The topics we've covered are the topics we're going to cover, and I certainly hope that all of you will do well. I hope some of you will choose to become psychologists. And certainly I also want to be sure that we acknowledge that Scott Wharton and Wang Nguyen are the two people who have been taping all of this for us and taking good care of us and making sure you use your microphones and things like that. And also I want to thank their leader, Phil Booth, who has made all of this possible. So I wish you good luck, and our course is now finished.